The 1950s, America and Korea were at war. The space race took off with the launch of Sputnik. The Cold War was heating up, and comic books came under fire. With the threat of nuclear attack came the concern of radiation and its effect on life. Fears of a communist invasion, technological advances, and creatures from beyond our moon spread across the country. But worry not, my friends, for you are safe in the spoiler room with the crew. So grab your favorite drink and pull up a chair as they discuss monster films from this decade in
It Came From the 50s.
Yes, my friends, it is the last It Came From the 50s episode special. I hope you've enjoyed this series this year. It's been a lot of fun visiting these, and I figured, why not, with it being October, we finish off the series with a classic, in quotes, horror film. And it is The Blob from 1958. And I got a great group of crew members to join me in talking about this film for our last It Came From the 50s episode. First off, it's the diva of the spoiler room. She is with us tonight. Hello, Dawn.
Good evening, Mark. Good evening, gentlemen.
So glad to have you in the spoiler room with us to talk about The Blob. And next to her, returning to us, taking a small break from preparing for the new horror film festival, it is Mr. Paul Salzar with his bow tie. Hello, Paul. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. I'm excited about talking about The Blob.
Well, I'm glad somebody is. And next to Paul, he's back with us once again. Listen to the sultry, dulcet tones of Scotty D. Hello, Scotty D. How are you, sir?
Hello.
Oh, yeah.
I had to be sultry because you were trying to sell it, you know?
I was trying to sell it. That's some sultry tones right there.
You're putting the pressure on, so.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. So, tonight, since he hasn't been in the spoiler room for a little while, I think we'll have Paul. Why don't you tell our fine listeners out there what The Blob 1958 is about?
It's a science fiction film about a creature that comes from outer space and about a group of teenagers that go through town trying to convince the adults that this monster is around consuming individuals and growing and growing and growing.
There you go. Starring
Steve McQueen.
Yes, starring the man himself.
On purpose, even.
McQueen on purpose. Yeah, that's not
wow.
Steve. He should have took the 10%, though, instead of the set fee.
Agreed.
Be collecting those royalty checks forever. I mean, that. And then the singer of the Monster Mash, that's how he made his entire living off of one song.
Oh, wow.
Living off of this. But I digress. Yes, it is The Blob. It will go down as we always do and just get initial thoughts of this film, and then we'll dive deeper into some of the finer points of this film. So first off, we will start with Scotty D, The Blob, your initial impression with this film. Do you remember when you first saw it?
Yeah, well, I kind of have a blur of when I first saw it because...
Were you drinking that much?
No, I was a little kid.
Oh.
And I didn't start drinking until I was at least, you know, six.
Like a true Midwesterner.
It was me and Drew Barrymore. And we were hanging, but anyway, the they used to run this and the sequel of Beware the Blob, sometimes called Son of the Blob, on TV a lot, and I used to get a blur of it, and I was scared of any horror movie practically back then, but I kept finding myself in front of them anyway. And if it was an old movie, I could sometimes take it. For some reason, The Blob scared the crap out of me as a kid. Just the whole idea of, like, it's like, what is it? It's nothing. It's just this blob. It can go anywhere. And when it has you, it just, like, eats you slowly. I'm like, oh, my God, that's horrible. That's horrible. And, of course, now you look at it, and this film is so – it's downright cute. it's so cute, you watch it now, and I mean, I'm sure it was like, you know, I'm sure it was like this, like, thrilling, like, you know, teenage, like, movie back then. And now you watch it, it's like, oh, man, this is just, like, good, wholesome fun, this movie, with this blob, this big, giant, you know, piece of Jell-O that, like, starts, you know, eating people and everything. And I thought that I still like the Blob. So I'm going to probably – and from what I hear, I might not be a – I might be alone in this, but I think I've seen the Blob a bunch, and it's a, and I think it's a really fun, breezy little movie to sit down and enjoy.
Awesome. Awesome. Great memory. Thanks for sharing that. And Paul, how about you in the Blob? You remember when you first saw it?
I did. And sadly enough, I honestly, I would have swore up and down that it was in black and white when I saw it, but it was never in black and white. It's just for some reason I thought that all they did was colorize the blob. But then when I watched the film very recently for this podcast, it was like, wait, this is in color. And I was really surprised by that. And it was actually done in very good color. I was very impressed with the quality of the reproduction. And when I first saw it, I think just like any other kid, it was just like, ooh, this is a crazy movie. And then I think I remember the 80s version of it much more than the 50s version.
Many people do.
Yeah, and it's just I hope we get to eventually talk about the two different films and possibly contrast them. I enjoy, I think now as an adult, this film and appreciate it more for what it has done rather than what it was.
Well, unfortunately, Paul, you'll have to wait because actually next week, it's a little spoiler here, next week I am covering the 1988 Blob with Mr. Glenn and Andrew. So we could talk a little bit about it.
We could talk a little bit about it here,
but I was planning on doing it next week. So, but we can still talk a little bit about it here.
Yeah,
we may not go too deep into it. Just letting you know ahead of time because we're gonna I'm gonna be talking about it with those two fine gentlemen next week. But that's great that you at least seem to enjoy it. Though you like the '80s one, I'm taking a little bit better.
I did. Yes.
So, Don, how about you? And the first time you watched The Blob.
I don't remember the first time I saw it, truly. Okay. I remember I loved the creature.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to go back to seeing it when I was younger, I found it less interesting, and I realized why on the viewing that I did last night, I realized why it didn't really touch with me besides how awesome the creature is. And of course, you know, the theme song is Amazeballs.
Yes.
Beware of the blob. It creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch. Be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob.
Kudos, Burke Baccarat. But aside from the creature and the theme song, I realized last night the reason it didn't touch, I couldn't connect with the movie, is because it's such an angry movie.
Mm-hmm.
Everything about it is angry.
And that's an awesome description. Could you elaborate maybe a little more for listeners what you mean by that it's an angry film?
Oh.
I'll give you one example of why you describe it as angry. What was it?
The entire tone of the movie is angry. Mm-hmm. I appreciate what they were trying to do.
I can think of one character right offhand that you're talking about.
You're thinking about one of the deputies and yes. Him being very angry with the teenagers. And that's true. He's very convinced that everybody's out to get him and they're picking on him. But the teenagers are angry because nobody will believe them and they're fighting to save their community. And every scene they go to, they're mocked, belittled, and there's so much tension and anger because they're just not taken seriously. Where a decade earlier, World War II, kids their age were fighting the war.
Right. Right.
And there's just so much anger in this film about everything. You go into the the hardware store and who's breaking in?
Yeah.
Deal with the parents. My kid wouldn't lie, but there's just so much anger in this movie. Steve McQueen is just an angry guy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, they go to the doctors and he tries to show the deputy and they're, oh, you kids are just playing pranks on us. And they're constantly not believed. I definitely get that tone. Scott, how about you? What do you think about that angle of a lot of people are angry in here?
It's a new take. I actually hadn't heard that before. And respect it, incidentally, but I think that was kind of going around. What they were doing was they were making two kinds of movies here. They were making the monster movie, and then they were also making a juvenile delinquent movie. But in this case, the juvenile delinquents aren't actually, you know, go nowhere criminals. They're just misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of painted it from the other side. So it painted it where everybody's, you know, kind of against the kids, you know, the kids are really just trying to do their best to talk some sense into people. And this is something I think that, you know, kind of continued in a lot of films throughout the 50s and the 60s. Another film that was released around the same time that has kind of that idea was Invasion of the Saucer Men?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of stuff where the kids are all in their cars and everything like that, and they're just drag racing and everything, and they're like, oh, those hoodlums, why don't they respect the community? And in fact, they do respect the community, and that's basically the lesson. And it does usually take people who will listen to them to get things. And I think this kind of, you can see this kind of trend continue throughout films in the 60s and the 70s. Heck, we even saw it in films into the 80s. I mean, if you replace, you know, the Blob with a more abstract horror, War Games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, War Games is these two kids. Oh, these kids are just hoodlums and no one believes them and stuff, but really they're the ones trying to save the world from destruction, you know? And I think that with that, they do that. And of course, that's done naturally because they're trying to get the kids in the theater and the kids are being like, yeah, right on. We're just misunderstood. Come on. Gosh, golly gee. I just want to get a soda pop and everybody's hassling me, you know, that kind of stuff. But I think that, and I think that's what they were doing. I think they were playing into the youth audience by tapping into that sense of alienation about not being understood, about not being listened to. And, of course, the moral of the story comes, listen to them and you might not get eaten. I get what Don's saying. I respectfully disagree. I think it was just one of the films that was really starting to pick up that trend of transferring the juvenile delinquent films into the misunderstood youth as heroes film. So,
and you still can get the anger in there with that miscommunication. Though it is interesting too, you mentioned the teenage hooligan films, because unlike another, you know, most teenage films, because you had the two groups, you had the guy that, you know, the pissing contest with the car because Steve McQueen's character passed the group of boys who thought they were the fastest on the road. And so they have that odd drag race backwards, which I thought was very interesting. But even then, those kids are banded together protecting each other. So even though they may have a clash of their egos, when it came push came to shove, they banded together against the the people who didn't believe, the adults, you know, screw the adults don't believe us. We'll believe you before, you know, the adults believe you.
Right. It's like what if instead of, you know, playing a game of chicken and killing each other and rebel without a cause, they all banded together against an alien menace.
Yeah, well, there you go. Paul, how about you? What do you think of that angle of there's a lot of anger in the film?
Oh, I agree with Don that there is anger in the film. You see it on both sides of the teenagers versus the parents and so forth. And kind of the creature itself, the blob, it's kind of this, like, it didn't show any anger. It just showed, like, hunger. And it just kept going and growing and growing. But I think, in a way, that's kind of a metaphor for anger as well. Because if you just leave it alone, it's just going to keep growing and devouring. So I think Dawn was really spot on with her anger theme mentioned. And I would also I wanted to add, but she already had mentioned, was the whole idea of these were soldiers a few years ago, you know, like a decade ago. These kids, you know, they were good enough to go off to war and defend the country and so forth. And now they're being reduced to these, you know, hoodlums and you know, they're easily blamed as oh, you know, that's a prank, or you're probably the one that trashed the doctor's office and that sort of stuff. And the other thing that you can get from this is I couldn't help but notice how even today we do the same thing where I was in Applebee's yesterday and I was sitting with my friends and I looked around and we were surrounded by millennials and I realized that and we were sitting there and we were kind of joking and picking on them and I realized that we had suddenly become the adults that we had picked on or that, you know, when we were the teenagers,
we're being picked on.
Yeah. Like, well, the adults were picking on us. We were picking on them. So now we're sitting in Applebee's and we're basically doing the same thing. We're picking on the millennials and probably they were doing the same thing that we're picking on us. It's like, you know, those old dudes over there, why are they coming to our restaurant? Cause we were completely surrounded by people that were way younger than we are. So it was kind of an awkward experience.
You were in Applebee's.
I know.
You voluntarily went into Applebee's, so you just asked for it there. Well,
the reason for it is we normally have a standing thing at Perkins on Tuesday nights.
And, oh boy, if that doesn't spell how old you are.
Hey, exactly.
We're going to Perkins. We didn't have an Applebee's in Stillwater, so the place where all the teenagers hung out when I was a kid was Perkins.
Yes.
Oh, and nice, every yeah. single night you just went to Perkins and you just waited for people to show up.
Nice. Well, they were replacing a soda machine, so they actually kicked everybody out at the time that we go, so
lame.
This That's is why. Important work here. Yeah.
Well, it's one of those fancy Coke machines, you know. You just don't get the four flavors of Coke. You get the thousand flavors of Coke, you know.
So yeah. I have to. we have to address the biggest elephant in the room, though, with this movie. Now, every one of us have said the word teen.
That he's 27 years old.
we have all said the word teen, and I understand getting 20 somethings to play teenagers, but Don, Steve McQueen as a teenager, and his love wasn't, she was 25, but she at least, you know, she looked a little bit younger. But did you believe at all that Steve McQueen was supposed to be a teenager?
No, not at all. I kind of looked at where his parents were supposed to be and went, I'm not sure that's possible. Yeah. No, you know, no. Definitely, it was a thing that happened back. A lot.
I mean, I know they do that, but I mean, you know, they didn't even try with some makeup or something with him. I mean, there's some scenes in there where you're like, Jimmy Stewart? What? I mean, he just...
I thought he looked like Anthony Michael Hall.
What?
Yeah.
Well, like Anthony Michael Hall now, not when
now,
he
yes.
Not Breakfast yeah, Club no. Anthony Michael Hall. No, we're talking about now Anthony Michael Hall. Yeah.
Dead Zone Anthony
Michael Hall. Dead Zone Michael Hall. I couldn't believe it. I'm watching it going, this is a bit awkward because he just looks older. I mean, casting, I understand casting, but Scotty D, Steve McQueen as a teenager, really?
Oh yeah, no, that's no. There's no defense. They always did this where they would cast older people as teenagers, and I mean, you can see it. Sometimes they do it now. Thankfully, when they do it, they are getting called out on it more.
Yeah.
Because it's now it's annoying, and back then it was so common. It reminds me of the old MST3K episode. Which I want to say is Ring of Fear, when they talked about the old school, and it was like all the kids that are at City College or something, and they're obviously like in danger of like they're needing to take classes about how to deal with hip replacement and everything. The Blob wasn't the only thing that was gumming their food in this movie.
Well, because her dad looked like they couldn't cast another older person, so they dyed his hair white or powdered it white in a mustache. I tried to look up some information on the guy who played her dad, and I couldn't find an age for him, but he looked like... some bad age makeup on him. Like yeah. It was, a high school play, and they grabbed the young guy who's got to play the old guy, and so they stuck his hair in white flour.
That was usually me.
Oh. Scott played the old man.
Played a lot of old guys.
I mean, I know this was his first, like Steve McQueen's first leading role in a film, and I understand that. I mean, maybe for name recognition because he was in a number of shows before then, but I just think he was miscast. Paul, what do you feel about Steve McQueen in this role?
Honestly, I thought he was fine. I didn't care about his appearance. I think it came to me was that he had the proper attitude, this kind of rebel type of feeling. So he felt young to me. He didn't look young, not at all. I agree with you guys there. But he just felt young to me, and it just might be because I kind of wanted to be like him. Because as a teenager, I wasn't like him. I was definitely not the guy that did the racing backwards, that sort of stuff. I wasn't cool. So... I think that's what I did, is I projected my wants and needs onto this character.
Wow.
Who cares if the frame was nearly 30 years old?
Well, it wasn't just look, though. For me, his acting was just a little bit too mature for that role, too, the way he played it. I don't know. For me, I didn't buy it all. Had they played it off like he had gone to college for a year and came back, I would have taken it because, he'd more worldly or whatnot. But when he even tries to play awkward, he just doesn't, for me, do awkward that well. When he's, I don't take any girls up here to look at falling stars. The first one. And I'm like, dude, you aren't even believable. I'm like, and this is awkward because you look 30-something and she at least, she seemed to have the energy and stuff a little bit more. Steve McQueen didn't quite feel like he had that youthful energy. I'm not sure if maybe that was the direction.
It might be.
Trying to take with his character, trying to be more mature than what he is, though he is mature. So,
I thought he had kind of like a Jack Kerouac type feel, like that. That's the his type of learning. He was kind of that type of character. To me, that's what made him young. So.
But, I will say this. I don't know how old everybody's folks are in this group. I can tell you mine are in their mid-70s. So they went to school in, like, the 50s was when they were the age that you're supposed to be in this movie. Mm. If you look back – and they don't look as quite as old as the kids in – quote unquote kids in this movie. But have you ever looked at like your parents' like yearbooks from like the 40s or 50s or whatever and thought, gosh, kids looked a lot older back then. You know, that's another thing that always strikes me is whenever I look back on these things, I'm like, man, all these kids always look so old. They're so obviously 30. And then when you look back at like some old yearbook from that era, you're like, but you know what? A lot of these 18-year-olds look 25, so it's not that much of a stretch.
That's very true. That's very true. And we did mention, you know, angry youth is in here, but we also have the issue of being addressed of veterans possibly not getting the respect from the youth because the times they be a-changing. In the one, who is it? The one deputy, who is it? Officer Ritchie, was it? Or I forgot which one it was. I do apologize. But there was the one veteran in here who had a teenager who apparently ran into an accident with his wife. But man, was he grumpy. I could get grumpy old man on, but this guy just had it out for the teens. I mean, To a really excessive amount, but it felt like they were possibly trying to speak to the older folks or, you know, addressing how youth are bringing to light. Since this is directed towards youth, Paul, would you say maybe that they were trying to use this character to speak to the youth saying, hey, treat our veterans better because it makes them very angry?
Yes. And I think also too, it was kind of a cinematic shortcut for them. They needed to say a whole bunch of things, and they just gave that one character that voice so that he could represent every one of their thoughts about this particular group. Mm-hmm. And I think that was just, it was a shortcut, but it was nice. It kept the film not bloated. So I appreciate that they did that.
Well, maybe give him another villain besides the Blob, because we don't actually see that much of the Blob.
That's very true. That is so true.
Scotty D., what do you think of this? The veteran who gets picked on by the youth and who just really has it out for him. I mean,
I liked what they did with this character. I thought that they did not, since they were aiming for this audience, they did not have to give this dude an a motivation for being the way he is. He could have just been a dick. You know, a lot of movies would be like that. You know, it's just like, well, this is the way you are. Okay, now why am I the way it is? Well, you can make up your own bullshit backstory, but really you're just a dick. you know, but this one I really thought they actually did this. And they play, and obviously the guy himself, though, if you listen after that, he's delusional.
Yeah.
He's not just a veteran. He's delusional about his veteran status. He says, well, maybe they're after me because they know about my war record. You know, who the hell's going to do that? You know, no, it was a thing. I think I read him as a guy who had experienced this horrible tragedy and is now like clinging to this thing that he achieved years ago, knowing that he's never going to be that hero. He couldn't be the hero for his family. He couldn't save them. And so now here he is stuck as a deputy in a town where nothing really ever happens, living out the rest of his life, you know, alone. And all he has to look back on is this, and he's bitter as hell about it. And is it a good excuse? No, but it's actually pretty plausible. And I liked that towards the end, you know, even though he's not the one they go with, he's the sharpshooter out there.
Yeah.
And there's no real hard feelings or anything about that, you know, because no one really hates him. They're just like, oh, man, he's always on our case. You know, He just won't cut us a break. And it's because I don't think they needed to do that. And I like that they did. I always thought that was a nice little touch.
Yeah, Paul chatted a little bit, and it could be that they were addressing something that really wasn't probably talked about back then, huh, Don? PTSD?
They called it shell shock then, but right. Yeah.
Yeah. And
it was definitely, we think mental illness is a big deal now. It was much worse back then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as far as the stigmatism.
Well, especially back then, because there were still these standards or expectations put on these people when they came back. And if you showed any sign of anything other than what that expectation was or standard culturally, it was horrible for you in all respect. I mean, you're right. How'd you feel about this deputy? I mean, do you think maybe they were using this character to make a statement about how youth treats their veterans in a way?
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It was definitely in place to draw attention to the fact that 10 years, 12 years prior, when he was in the war and his military record, he was the same age that these kids are now.
Right.
That was most definitely intentional. Whether it was a question of how society treated the veterans and how the kids were treating the veterans, that might have been more of a stretch. But I definitely think it was to draw attention to this is what this police officer was doing when he was their age, and here's these other kids just screwing around now.
Right.
It was a completely different world.
Completely different world. He had to grow up quick, and these kids don't seem to want to grow up.
Exactly. And they weren't required to.
Right. And they're not required. They didn't have it as hard as we did. You know, the Yorkshire Men skit from Monty Python comes to mind. Well, you know, in my day, we had it tough. in a way.
Yep.
You could also take that what we were just talking about and kind of flip it on its end too, because he at a young age knew what was capable of teenagers of his age, that they were able, you know, the evilness of killing other people. So he knew that teenagers could think on this level. So it's a very interesting thing to really think about. It's like, we're probably thinking so far deep into this character. It's amazing.
Yeah, they probably just wrote it for the hell of it, just for cinema's sake, and we're sitting here diving into, metaphor. But, hey, that's why I love this show, and I love you guys on this. Now, of course, we have the title character, which, again, watching this, I hadn't watched it in ages. And watching it again, Scotty D., people complained about the Godzilla film that came out, yet you didn't really see too much of the title character. You honestly don't see too much of the title character here till the last bits of the film. What do you think of the Blob itself?
See, that's such a strange thing because, and when I looked at this last time, I'm like, yeah, you don't see as much of this as I remember. Also, what I didn't remember was even though this is probably like my eighth time seeing it, I thought he doesn't really kill that many people either.
No, he doesn't.
I always remember this just as being this rampage. So again, it was like a blur with the sequel,
right?
Which is, you know, not as good.
Yeah,
but you don't see quite as much. But it's, you got to remember, you know, also Godzilla, I don't give a thing to because it was a $200 million movie.
No, I get you.
The budget. Sure. This one.
Not nearly the budget. Yeah, no, I get you.
Sometimes you had to hide the monster until the end. And so I kind of forgave it a little bit more. I kind of, you expect it. And, you know, you can tell when they're just pushing a jello mold through some fake theater doors. And
I love that bit.
And then you can also see like the bits where it's like, no, this thing is actually moving on camera. I mean, they had to do like some like stop motion stuff to do that. You know?
Yeah.
And you know, so they had to be a little like, I don't know what the budget of this was.
$240,000.
Oh, that's right. I read about that, and then somebody else said it was actually closer to $120,000.
Yeah, well,
and one of the producers said 240, and then the director came up years later and said, It's closer to 120. And
well, that's the old additive. Always get, you know, always estimate higher if someone asks you, so you can get more money for the film.
Oh yeah, so Fredel and Ray just recently had a post on Facebook. I think it was about the one film that he directed for them, the Attack of the 60-Foot Centerfold or something like that, or one of those movies that Fredel and Ray did just like a few years ago, just the one that a few years ago they did.
Right.
And they says, yeah, Roger Corman went everywhere telling him it cost $2 million. Cost like $250,000. He says. You know, and I'm
always
like,
aim high. Always aim high.
So that's what they do. You know, they always like inflate it, and that's what they did here. So yeah, it's like 100. You're right. It's like 120, I think, from what I, if depending on who you believe, 240, 120,
right.
And they didn't have much. I was, you know, it's just amazing that this is a Paramount movie. It's not an indie film.
Yeah.
It's actually released by Paramount. I'm like, wow. But they had to hide the monster because. This wasn't a guy in a suit this time.
No, it was a blob of jelly.
They actually had to like somehow make, you know, they actually had to somehow make that, you know, that jello mold that your flaky aunt brings to Thanksgiving every year, turn it into like an unstoppable alien killing machine.
Yeah. Don, how'd you feel about our title character in this?
I thought they did a great job with it.
Mm-hmm.
It started out, I mean, when it started out small, it wasn't red.
Right. It was blue or clearer.
Yeah. Yeah. And then as it ate people, it changed color, which ties back into that anger thing that Paul brought up. It started out as, or heat even, it started out as cool. Blue or clear, mm-hmm. And then as it consumed people, it got more red and more red and more red, more angry, more hot, mm-hmm. And which leads right into how they defeated it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. They cooled it off,
mm-hmm.
with as many specifically CO2. It's got to be CO2 fire extinguishers.
And that's the thing that I actually do like about this movie is it had its version of logic and it stuck with it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it totally committed to whatever rules or whatever they came up with. They totally committed to it,
mm-hmm.
and held to it, which is a bit surprising.
There's no ambiguous, don't feed it after midnight.
Well, midnight central time or eastern time? It is Asian. Do you mean midnight after Japan midnight? I don't understand. China? I don't know.
Exactly.
Which midnight? Don't feed the blob ever. Paul, how about you? You feeling about the blob?
I have two things. Firstly, my memory of the blob was that it was a lot more pinker than it was. My memory of it was that it was like chewing gum.
I think you're thinking of the 80s one.
I think I am. But that leads to the second one, though, is that the 80s one and remember Creepshow, that they had the raft, or was it Creepshow 2?
Yeah.
That version of it seemed to me a lot more a lot more believable. Like this version of it, and I know it was the first one, it just looks so stiff, you know, when you saw it in the guy's hand, it was like, wow, you're wearing a rubber silicone glove. way to go, guy. but when you got to see it in the later movies, it felt like, oh my God, this is this oily, viscous thing. You could feel that it was getting into their pores and that it could actually eat you. It just felt like it could. Whereas this version, it honestly looked like a pulsating glob of meat. I mean, I have that on my frying pan every night, you know?
See, and I always picture, watching it again, I always remembered it. I thought it was black. No, I always thought it was darker than what it was. I didn't remember it actually being red for me. I don't know why I imagined that it was actually like black ooze,
mm-hmm.
More so than red. Not sure why on that, but... for me, yeah, I think they did well for the budget they had and the effects. They actually, I think it's effective what they do with the blob, character. even if parts of it look really badly composited for 58 compared to some of the other films that we've done for It Came from the 50s and the budget it was shot on, I think they do well with considering, as Dawn said, we've got something that's not a guy in a suit anymore. You can't fudge your way out of this. You have to in some way make this, you know, non-anamorphic creature.
But there was a scene where it was pushing into the room. It did actually look like a guy, like, pushing his head through. So that, to me, was kind of cool, you know?
Yeah, and they do a lot of cool things in here. You know, the blob going down the stairs, then back up with the CO2 in that. You know, that's why I love these films, especially these 50s sci-fi films. And I think you have to appreciate what they were doing. I think people are spoiled now by the effects and how they're done, but these guys were shooting from the hip. I mean, you know, they're winging it. They've got to figure out how to do that. I mean, can you imagine that? Some guy sitting there going, okay, so our monster is this, and he dumps a blob of pudding on the to make it scary. And the special effects guys are going, oh, fuck. You know, I could go put Phil in a blob suit. No, I want this. Ah, hell. All right. You know, but I enjoyed the title character, and it is, I think, out of all the 50s films, the monster films we have picked, this is the one that has the least form, for obvious reasons, but even still, isn't a person in a suit, or isn't a crafted puppet, you know. I mean, it's a gelatinous thing that could not have been easy to work with for, especially back then. But they do make it effective. I mean, there's the scene where it leaks under the door at first and then it goes away, you know. The scene where they throw the acid on it in the hospital, I think, was actually really effective. There are some actually pretty creepy scenes in here with this. They manage to make you believe this thing is alive enough to be a danger, which for a film like this is great. I personally, though, just didn't quite care for the character too much. I don't know why. I did like the cop. I liked the head, the sheriff, the main cop. I liked him quite a bit. And his character, the guy who's just kind of caught up in this crazy middle, trying to keep one side from beating the crap out of the other side. You know? So I liked him, but we do have, oh my God, outside of a couple supporting one-scene people, one female lead in this film. But it is 1958. Scotty D, we'll start with you. How did you feel about the lovely lady who would not leave her man's side? How'd you feel about her compared to maybe some of the other female 50s characters we've seen in films? Where does she fall, would you say?
When you think about a typical representation of a woman, or in this case it's supposed to be a young girl in a movie, this is unfortunately what you get, which is because different times, you know, she doesn't really do anything.
She goes after the dog a lot.
She goes after the dog, which I can respect, because I'm a big dog person, of course. I love dogs.
Sure.
And she doesn't really do anything, and I guess that was actually a sticking point with her. She was not happy with that because she wished her character did more in the movie. But all she does to show any real kind of motivation or gumption is to, you know, stand by her man, basically, and, you know, pursue him and pursue, what's he doing? Well, then I'm going to go meet him, you know, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, not great. but honestly, it's one of those things where you kind of, you look back on it, and if it was if it was atypical, then you would be like, "Hey, what the hell is this about?" Sadly, this makes it worse, if not better, is that, you know, you look at it and say, "No, this was actually quite typical for the era," which is, I think, why we do pick out characters that have a little bit more moxie than this character, like when we did them while back. Mm-hmm. And that's why we do it, because it stands out. It's something different. This, no, she didn't stand out at all. She was just kind of there to, you know, just be around. And, you know, it's a shame. It's a shame. Yeah, I'm going to say that right now. It's one of those things where all you can really do at this point is look back and say, I'm glad that we're learning. Mm-hmm. We haven't made it, not by a long shot, but I'm glad that we're learning at least. So,
yep. Paul, how about you with our one female lead?
Yeah.
She was pretty stereotypical.
Oh, yeah. And I said in a past show that I would no longer look at movies with my old eyes. I would look at it with my modern sensibility. So, yeah, I did not like her character. Yeah. Who cares if it was made in the 50s? She's a weak character. She had a lot more potential. There was a lot of opportunities for that character. Like Scott said, her basic thing was to find the dog, but how many times did she lose the dog in the movie and then to re-find the dog? And then she thought the dog was dead. And then some guy had to tell her that, no, the dog walked. I saw the dog over there. And that, you know, it was really bad. It could have been a much, much better character. That's another reason why the 80s film was a little bit better in that aspect, at least.
Yeah. Oh, Shawnee Smith was awesome in that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And Don, how about you with our Jane Martin, our one female lead, stereotypical 50s girl, would you say?
Yes, but not stereotypical sci-fi moth creature movie girl.
Okay.
I mean, think about it. Most of the other It Came from the 50s movies that we've talked about have had, with the exception of The Creature, which had the strong female villain, had really strong female leads.
Right, true.
Killer Shrews, The Crawling Eye. You know, they had, at least, even if they weren't for the 50s, they were very strong female leads. This film, it felt like they had the girls in there so that it, just to make it clear that it wasn't a town full of men.
Yeah,
which would have added a different dynamic completely to the story, I think. But yeah, it was disappointing, because you think in the beginning the way her character is, and maybe that is, now that you mentioned, Scotty, that she was disappointed with it, I think maybe that was a little bit just her.
Yeah,
she's got a little bit in the beginning where, you know, Steve McQueen's got her up in the hill and we're open up and he's like, you know, oh, look at the shooting stars. And she's just like not buying any line he says, like, at all. She's just like, yeah, yeah, you don't take girls up here,
And I think the most disappointing part was at the end, where it wasn't even her who was comforting her younger brother. It was Steve McQueen.
Yeah. Yeah,
that drove the nail in further in saying that she was just there to prove that it wasn't a town full of men.
She was really was basically a hanger on, very close to being a non-entity in the movie.
Yeah, she wasn't even really a damsel in distress, because she never really leaves his side. So she's never even like alone and being chased by the blob or whatever. She never leaves, you know, our man's side, so she doesn't even really get to be, you know, that. she really is just there for, because boys went out with girls.
Yeah, apparently a very talented actress. It's just a really thankless role.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you could see, you know, definitely it's just the way it was written. I'm not, nothing against her at all. She makes the most of the character, but you can just tell the way she was written this character was like added, you know, it was almost like, I mean, I could almost imagine the script writing procedure where they write the script, they're done, they give it to a proofer or whatever, you know, the producer, and he goes, you're missing something. What? Nothing. No, we got Steve McQueen in here. He's fighting the monster. All the kids joined together. No, he had, where's his girlfriend? you want him to have a girlfriend?
Yeah.
Okay. Give me 2 hours.
They had to put a love interest in every movie for a long time. It was just kind of like something that you just did.
Right.
And so that's what they did here. Unfortunately, they didn't ever, you typically write them as anything else but that. And I guess she had a big long career in TV and stuff, you know, yeah. Andy Griffith and all that stuff. So,
yeah, so I mean, you could tell the talent was there. It's just the way it was written, it felt like this character was kind of shoehorned in on the end, just like, no, you're just there to, you know. So that all the boys can relate to a guy and go, oh, hey, I can possibly one day meet a girl. Shucks, golly gee.
Which is also weird, too, because, like, I hear stories from my mom growing up back in the day, right? And her stories are really fascinating. It's like nothing like what you see in this film. It's like she was not like that lady. And maybe she was just unique. I don't know. I'd like to think that, like, everybody's mom was like my mom, you know? She was, like, interesting and had all these, like, wonderful things. Like, believe it, like, if that blob was coming in under the door, my mom would be, like, you know, broom handle, whack, 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 whack. She'd be, like, messing with it, you know? That would be my mom.
Let's remember the demographic for this. This isn't just targeting youth.
Yeah.
This is targeting male youth.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still during a period of time where the majority of your films, and we've mentioned it, that we've covered a lot of the, it came from the 50s where you did have the strong female character and it stood out because it was unusual. But here, especially, you have, it's still the male fantasy template of, you know, he's got the girl and he's got the answers. And, you know, I mean, this is still trying to appeal to not just youth, but male youth.
Yeah.
And so boys cardboard think about fantasy. Girls, so we have a girl in here. Because it is sad, but if you really took her out of the film, not a single thing is lost.
The dog would have probably died. The dog would have died.
Not the motivation of your hero. It's like you just tweak a little, and unfortunately...
Well, you would have lost the dynamic with the dad, though, you know.
the three minutes of the dynamic of the dad, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. Just, you know, I mean, you had to have a little bit of that, you know.
Well, again, appealing to the boys, though, because boys, you know, face that with fathers and the daughters and the, you know, they're dating or whatnot. So.
All right.
It is definitely yet a sign of it coming from a different era. And it is, like, as Dawn said, it is different for a sci-fi film, though, her character, even for then, because science fiction in general, regardless of either the 50s, 60s, 70s, has a bit of a reputation of usually, not always, but usually having stronger female roles than you see in other genres of film during that time. But in this case, they kind of dropped the ball with it, or dropped.
Well, also typically, the blob. Typically, you got to remember how they were playing to the audience, and women were. It's just crazy, but women were. It's almost like women were seen as people who would ever have an independent thought of their own. The idea was that men went to the movies, and then they brought their girlfriends with. It was never about, like, oh, the girls are all going to see the new Dracula movie. Mm-hmm. You know, it was always like the boys are taking their girlfriends so that their girlfriend will clutch their arms and hold them tight, you know. And that was the idea, especially with the ones that were aimed at younger audiences. And it's antiquated. It's sexist. And unfortunately, it is on full display in the Blob.
Well, let's also not forget, and correct me if I'm wrong, Don, we're still looking at films being made by gentlemen who believe their ladies are like Barbara Billingsley in Leave It to Beaver.
Oh, yeah.
You know, pearls and dressed up as if they're going to go to, you know, church, but not. You're just staying home, but you better be this way and have my food ready, dang it, because I've had a long day at work. Mm-hmm. You know,
that was the woman's job.
Yeah.
I think the perfect little movie set for when their men come home.
Yes.
I was going to add that I think one of the reasons why science fiction films tend to be less misogynistic than other films is because I think science fiction lends itself more to story. So it's more important to get the story's themes out. So it doesn't really, it doesn't focus too much on characters. Whereas like, dramas and romances, they would focus on the characters and they tend to botch up the whole people aspect because they focus on them. Whereas science fiction, it doesn't really matter who gives out the information so long as the information gets out there, and that's the most important thing about a science fiction film. So I think maybe that's one of the reasons why it seems that science fiction tends to be a lot more fair.
Yeah. I mean, and of course there's always exceptions in general, you know, there's always exceptions. Not all sci-fi paints their female characters stronger either. you know, but yeah, this is definitely from a different time, and going through these 50s films has been really interesting to see the perspective, and it really gives you kind of a window of the kind of changing times that were happening in the 50s, coming out of the war and that, and what was paranoia, what was changing, what was going on can come through. And usually your sci-fi films especially are an indicator of what's going on in the real world. And I think this collection that we looked over this past year was a good example of the wide scope of things going on in real culture that was being expressed through the films. So I think we'll wrap it up tonight. We'll do like we have done with every It Came from the 50s special, and this is our last one. But I still will pose the question to all of our board members. So we will start with Dawn. Dawn, what is one thing of the 50s that you learned from the Blob?
Don't disregard warnings regardless of their source.
Nice. Nice. I like that. That could still be applied today.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. That's a lesson that people need to really pay attention to. Well done. I like that answer. And Paul, how about you? What about the 50s did you learn with the Blob?
When it comes to the dynamic between parents and teenagers, it doesn't matter what 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, the noughties, it's all the same. Parents don't always trust the teenagers. Teenagers don't always trust the parents. That's what
trust
I learned.
Trust me, folks. Parents just don't understand.
Oh!
There's a deep cut for you. Scotty D, the 50s, what'd you learn from the Blob?
There's always room for Jell-O, even in Jell-O.
There's always room for Jell-O. Oh, and what did I learn from the 50s? That the 50s, even back then, warned us of the dangers of global warming. Because the immortal final words of Steve McQueen, they're taking the Blob to the Arctic. And as long as the Arctic stays cold, the Blob will be frozen and we will be safe. As long as, I mean, the way he drops, as long as it stays cold, suddenly I'm like, are you setting it up for a sequel where the Arctic gets warm and the Blob releases? What the hell? Are you hinting at global warming? Oh my God, you're prophetic, Steve McQueen, who's 28 playing 18.
Spoilers.
Yeah. I am 28 going on 17. Anyway. And there you have it, folks. Our last It Came from the 50s. Hope you enjoyed this romp through some of these monster films from the 50s. I'm still working on what our special may be for next year, but we're going to do something a little bit different because we like to keep things on our – keep people on their toes and just do something different. Keep things moving. The next 2 months, November and December, are going to be Alfred Hitchcock month. Yes, yeah. 8 weeks of Alfred Hitchcock. So prepare yourselves for that. We got some great horror stuff for the rest of October, including our faves of the fest. And now this is a part where people get a license to shill. So shill the hell out of yourselves, folks. Dawn, where can they find you at?
Well, you can find me in theaudience.net.
Fantastic. Some great reviews there. She just did a retrospective on, was it Jurassic Park?
Yep, the first three. Still working on the next two.
Yes, so check that out. Some great stuff. She writes far better than I ever could. So some great reviews there as well. And Mr. Paul Salzer, I know you got something to plug.
Yeah, I got two things, actually. The first thing, of course, is the Northeast Wisconsin Horror Film Festival, which is October 13th and the 14th here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. All the proceeds will go to the Time Theater of Oshkosh. It's just basically 2 days full of wonderful short films as well as feature-length horror films. And so I hope that everyone gets to go see that. The second thing I'd like to plug is, of course, Film Jerks. Basically, at Film Jerks, you can join the cinema conversation. It's the podcast where we basically look at movies like little old ladies in a book club. So, and you can learn about it on our Facebook page, which is www.facebook.com/groups/filmjerks.
Fantastic. And Scotty D, I know you haven't done anything for a while, but it's still out there. And as you alluded to at the beginning of this podcast, my man, you are pretty good at the in-depth analysis. Tell them about your stuff.
Well, my stuff is out there still. It is, it's on moviocrity.com. And if you want to, that's where my writing is. And if you want to catch my old web series, best place is vimeo.com/channel/moviocrity. Want to get back into this stuff. Got a bunch of stuff. Every time I want to get going, something gets in the way. Right now, I got a little bit of a health thing. But once it all gets finished here, hopefully I have a chance to get everything going again.
Oh, absolutely. I have complete faith you will soon and be able to share your insights still on those films that don't get enough insight sometimes. So there you have it, folks. Check out all these fine folks' stuff, some great things. I appreciate every single one of you. This is 201. Yes, we were past the 200 mark for episodes. I got some great stuff lined up for you this month, including, you'll keep an eye on our website and on the Facebook page, which I'll have the little me plug here in a minute, but there may be a review of the new Gags film coming up next week sometime. Also, we'll have coverage of the new Horror Film Festival. I just went crazy, and so you'll want to look to our YouTube channel soon. Subscribe so you don't miss the reviews that I do of every single film that shows at the fest. So a lot of great stuff here on the channel. Thank you so much for listening. Now, say goodnight, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
J-E-L-L-O. Hey, all my friends out there looking for more spoiler room goodness, then why don't you check out our brand new Patreon page, patreon.com/specialmarkproductions, where you can get access to exclusive spoiler room episodes and a whole lot more. You can also find us on Facebook groups at SMPRD and on to Twitter at Special Mark Pro. Let your voice be heard and let us know what you would like to see in the spoiler room, as well as just how we're doing in general. We appreciate your support, and remember, in the spoiler room, the conversation is fresh, but we do spoil the movies.